Tell me what you think about the election of Arnold Schwarzenegger as the governor of California.
Arnold who?
Ropinator?
Have you read Michael Moore's new book, Dude, Where's My Country?
I haven't read it yet, but I know about it.
His reaction is, Oprah Winfrey for president. And think about it. She's so rich, she won't take bribes. She'll be completely uncorrupted. She's smart. She's got all the right ideas. Well, in fact, a lot of people could beat George II easily. I mean, what about Paul Newman? or Robert Redford?
Yeah.
They'd be a walk-in. I mean, that's what's taken over America, the whole country being brainwashed by television.
Yeah.
So it's we're in the grip. Most of the population is in the grip of this electronic gadget, which they've sold to the population en masse, and so that everyone has gotten this electronic consciousness today. I mean, it's Hollywood televised conscious. And you can't argue with people, say you don't think that Mr. Rumsfeld is a good guy, you don't think that maybe Mr. Cheney is so hot and you're not so sure about George II. You can't argue with people who don't agree with you because they're getting 95% of the people are getting 95% of their news from the television. And I saw it on television. It's true. That's where. What can you do? So, that's my answer.
Okay. I want to ask you some of this one especially, but how does the 1950s climate compare with the times we're living in through now in this country? And is it all similar? And how? What do you think about that?
Well, I think it's. The 1950s grew into the MacArthur era, E-R-R-O-R. And I mean, it was a very repressive period. But I think it's more repressive today, and people should be paying attention. They should read this Patriots Act, the U.S. Patriots Act. You know what I mean? Thank God for the American Civil Liberties Union. Maybe we can save the Constitution yet, but we're going to hell in a handbasket the way it's going now.
Well, that led me into my next one. Do you think freedom of speech and civil liberties are under attack today? You know, what do you think?
No doubt about it. I mean, another thing that everyone should read, you can read it on the internet, is the Project for the 21st Century. I don't know how many of you heard of it, but it was commissioned as a study and published as a white paper, before the present Bush administration. And its authors, or the people doing it, were Cheney, Rumsfeld,
Wolfowitz,
and Pearl. And this is a shocking document. If you get on the internet and find it, it's easy to find. Because it proposes world domination, complete world domination by the United States. I mean, it's the war in Iraq, they're going there, never mind about Iraq, they want to establish a base in the Middle East to control the whole region. And they're not going away under the present administration. They're going to be there indefinitely. So you might as well get ready to pay for it. And that's only part of this document. It's a shocking document.
You said that you thought that the, change it a little bit, and I'll come back to some of that else. You said you thought that the phenomenon of the B generation was overdone, has been overdone. Could you kind of elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, I think, you know, we tend to look back on the time when we were young and full of beans and full of a lot of other things. And That's a glorious time, you know. We've got all these girlfriends, et cetera. Or boyfriends. And so I think it's been glorified too much. I mean, I think today is much more exciting than the 1950s were by far. Mm-hmm. And the challenges are much greater today for everybody, and especially for poets and artists.
Who are some of your all-time favorite poets, painters, and musicians? Just if you want to, who influenced
Monk
you?
Monk is the one I listened to more than anybody in the 50s.
Thelonious Monk?
Yeah.
Why? And
I don't know. Oh, he was nearby. He was in the next block.
He was in the next block.
The Jazz Workshop. And but generally, the jazz in the 50s. Cool jazz. It really didn't turn me on.
Okay.
Generally, everyone sitting in dark corners, snapping their fingers, and wearing dark glasses, what happened with cool jazz when the rock revolution started? It's a little same as what happened when Allen Ginsberg published Howl. Before Howl, it was City Lights published in 1956. Poetry was very academic in this country, and the king of the poetry mountain was Carl Shapiro. He was editor of Poetry Chicago. Now, that was it. If you wanted to be a success in poetry, you had to get published in Poetry Chicago, and so forth. When Howl was published, it just knocked the sides out of the poetry world, just the way when rock came in and you didn't hear any more cool jazz.
Yeah.
And that's the way it went.
You told me today when we were at breakfast, you told me this morning that you didn't consider yourself a beat, but that you were associated with them because you published many of their books. Can you talk about that, elaborate?
Yeah, I wasn't a member of the original beat group. Ginsberg never really, he viewed me as a publisher. I was his publisher. So I was his publisher and editor for some 40 years till finally Harper and Row bought him out for a large amount of money in his last years. But I got associated with the Beats by publishing them, Ginsberg and Gregory Corso and Kerouac and Burroughs. I was in San Francisco. We started City Lights Bookstore in June 53. And they arrived shortly thereafter. They were, the Beats, they were all New York carpetbaggers, including myself. And no one was publishing them. I mean, they had all these great manuscripts. They just pulled them out of rucksacks, back pockets everywhere. He had plenty of manuscripts.
Yeah.
So we just dove right in.
What do you think about publishing today? What do you think about publishing? Where do you see the future of publishing going? Is it with large publishers, small, medium sized? What do you think?
I think the small and medium sized independent publisher really the hope and future of publishing in this country, because the big ones have gotten all conglomerized. They're all part of these big conglomerates in New York, with a few, very few exceptions. Mm-hmm. What's happening is that the chain bookstores and the mass distributors of books really have driven the independent bookstores out of business. So right now there's only about a third as many of the independent bookstores as there were 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And the main market for City Lights books, which were in the line of New Directions and Grove Press, like really counterculture, most of our books were bought by these independent bookstores. So now a press like ours is really in trouble because the bookstores are all wiped out that we used to sell to. And they had some terrible practices, like Barnes & Noble, I don't mind mentioning the name, or couple of the others, we had a distributor, a national distributor. We have a policy, you couldn't return books after a certain amount of time, like 8 months or a year or something like that. And so, but they would ignore that and say 2 years later, a huge moving man would pull up in front of the distributor with 20,000 books, and they'd say, we couldn't sell them, they're unsaleable. Here, you gotta take them back, we're not paying a bill, goodbye. The language is a little more profane than that. Yeah, you know, just walk away. Mm-hmm. It was disgusting. But and the trouble is that so many of the little presses now survive on government grants.
Right.
Like Copper Canyon Press is a wonderful press up in Washington State, Port Townsend, and they publish wonderful poetry books. And we can't afford to because we don't take government grants. But there's so many presses like that that live on NEA grants or other grants like that from the U.S. government. And I always thought it was pretty hypocritical for a press or a writer or a poet or an artist who considered himself on the left to take federal government money because they're just... For one thing, the government, with one hand, is giving you this money, but with its other hand, it's killing millions of people overseas in illegal wars. Mm-hmm. So I see a slight hypocrisy there.
With this whole idea of conglomerates and mass bookstores, how do you see it affecting the state of literature today? And do you see many poets and writers that you respect and love?
Oh, plenty. Uh-huh. I mean, there's more poets today than ever before, I think, and more poetry getting published. I don't know what's going to happen in the future with all these poetry presses, but it's really astounding. I can't keep up with what's coming out. There's so many. Much better than in the 50s, to make a comparison, I think.
Now? Yeah. How would you? I'm going to ask you a personal question. How would you evaluate your own poetry? What do you think are its weaknesses and strengths?
God.
You knew I was going to do it.
I'm not a professor. I really have to leave that to others. It's almost as bad as asking me how I write a poem. Do I get up first? Do I brush my teeth first? How do you go about it? Do you have a routine?
Yeah.
I always say trade secret.
Your routine?
I say it's a trade secret.
Okay.
So
okay.
That's why I'm not in the university.
That's why I retired. I just retired. I just did. Let's talk about your painting. You started in 1948. What do you paint every day?
Oh, well, I'm painting one way or another. Either with a pencil or with a brush. Yeah, I have a studio in the Hunters Point Shipyard. It's a big, big, enormous space. And so I've had a few shows.
Yeah.
I had a big show in Rome about 8 years ago in the Palace of Exhibitions, which is like the Met in New York. And I'm going to have one at the San Jose Museum of Art this spring.
Oh.
But the shows aren't really important. It's more, I'm really doing the same thing as in writing, you know. It's the same consciousness, the same sensibility.
Yeah. You know, Miles Davis said that. I mean, you know, when his last, before, when he started painting, he painted as much as he composed music, and as much as he practiced the trumpet.
What does a painting look like?
His paintings?
Is it
That's interesting.
Figurative or non-objective? Or?
Well, it moved from stick figures till he started getting pretty good before he died. But he painted every day. Every day he painted. And he thought it was important to him as much as music. So would you say it's as important to you as writing?
Yeah, I think so.
You think so?
Well, I do a lot of...
Other things besides oil painting, I've done a lot of engraving, rather not engraving, lithography on stone, and lots of drawing. I've been drawing from the model for, oh, since the, since the 40s. Before you were born, my dear. Yeah, and nothing like drawing from the model. I mean, and today, drawing, real drawing is in pretty much disrepute in art schools, evidently. It's like you can do it with a camera or you can do it on the computer. Why bother to learn how to draw?
You told me this today, this morning, about this recent boat trip down the Mississippi River.
Oh, yeah.
And who did you go with and why did you do it?
Well, I was on this raft with a pole. And
what were you doing?
I had a straw hat.
Straw hat? And, why'd you go?
Why?
Yeah.
Oh, well.
You went past my hometown.
I'm writing a book that's going to be, perhaps, I hope, three volumes. The first volume is already at the press at New Directions. It's called Americus. And it's the first volume starts in Europe and comes to the United States as a coming American would, not to mention Africa.
Yeah, that's true.
And but so then this, it's a little bit, slightly autobiographical. It's in New York. And then the first volume ends with the Kennedy assassination. The second volume is going to go west. I've got part of the Chicago section written already. And so I need to go on the Mississippi because I had a typical New Yorker's view of America. There's the skyscrapers in New York, and then there's this big slough, and there's a couple of palm trees on the horizon. So I really needed to get out there and see what was really there. And Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn would be really shocked today. Those river towns, those beautiful little river towns, they're all dying. It's happening not just along the Mississippi, all over Middle America. It's like the heart of America is dying. The little river town with the main street about five blocks long and lots of old, beautiful old brick buildings, about half of them are boarded up. Movie marquee, boarded up. And there's a mall 3 miles out of town on the freeway. And that's where all the family businesses got sucked out of. And so you have this everywhere. We went along the Mississippi, except a place like Hannibal where they make it on Tom Sawyer and on Mark Twain, because that's where Mark Twain is, where he grew up. He wasn't born there, actually. Mark Twain was born in a frontier town when it was still the frontier. Then when he was a little boy, they moved to Hannibal on the Mississippi, and that was not a frontier town, but it was a town, it was a pre-industrial culture. And what you get in Mark Twain, in Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn, is this idyllic pre-industrial culture, which is really gone now. I mean, it's there was, I don't know, it was, we went, there are locks and dams now. I started just south of St. Paul, went 800 miles south of St. Louis to Cairo, Illinois, which is spelled as in Cairo. And below there, you can't go on a raft because there these locks and dams, there's nothing but cement and huge ships and tugs and it was pretty impossible. There's no place to pull up on a beach and sleep. So, but we went through something like 25 locks and dams, and they're really something. You ever seen those?
Yeah.
Yeah,
Yeah, I'm from St. Louis. Yeah. You know, you said something this morning, and I would like to just comment on about, you talking about Furling, your family changed. It was Furling, and I don't think a lot of people know that. And then you changed your name. What did you
talk about? Well, when my father came to America about 1890, and he was an auctioneer, and he was a little like in Godfather 2. He was from Lombardy, and he didn't speak any English. He came through Ellis Island, and then he went into Little Italy, and he was a small-time shopkeeper and some kind of an auctioneer. And so he was doing favors for the local mafioso boss. And they moved up toward what's now Westchester County. They moved to Yonkers. But north of New York, the Anglo-Saxon suburbs of New York City, it was pure white, and it was like the Dago, the Italian, the WAP, was the lowest thing on the social ladder. So, the idea, you know, smelling of garlic and pepperoni, get away from those people. So the idea was to get away from that image as fast as possible. And I had four older brothers, and my family shortened the name to Furling, which took all the character out of it and sounded like a Scandinavian name or something.
Yeah.
When I came to my senses, which wasn't until I was in my 30s, I restored the name. Of course, you know, in the 60s, there was a great movement back to the roots.
Right.
And it was really part of that in a way. Yeah, that's what happened.
The last question I want to ask you is, what impact on this country do you think 9/11 has had on the consciousness of the people? What's the lasting impact of that, as far as you can see?
It was this huge paranoia that swept across the land, and it allowed Bush II to pass these restrictions on civil liberties and take away a lot of your liberties just because everyone was so paranoid. The huge wave of paranoia swept the land. It's still in effect, I think. So that...
You think it's scary?
You tell me. Yeah, it's scary.
It's scary.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you very much.
Oh, wait. One more thing. This is, I meant to pull this out before when we were talking about George II, who usurped the throne and is occupying the palace illegally. This is a bill, it's worth a 9-11, Project for a New American Century, fraudulent event note, one deception. What else you got on here? War and globalization, in fraud we trust. Follow the money. New World Order. Actually, that comes on the real dollar bills. Novum Ordem Secularum is on the New World Order. It came from Virgil. But here we have the New World Order. That's what we have today. So I'll make you a present of this. You can.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's great.